Welcome to the Novel Romantics Literature of Chicago podcast series at the Amerikazentrum Hamburg. I'm the host of Novel Romantics, Douglas Cowie. I'm a writer and teacher. Today we're going to be discussing Richard Wright's 1940 novel, Native Son, and my guest today is Ryan Gaddis. Ryan Gaddis, who you can find at ryangaddis.com. That's ryangaddis.com, is the author of Safe, Kung Fu High School, The System, and All Involved, the last of which won the American Library Association's Alex Award and the Lyra Award for Noir of the Year in France. He lives and writes in South Los Angeles, where he's a member of the art collective Uglar Works, a founding board member of arts nonprofit Heritage Future, and a Penn America prison writing mentor. Ryan, welcome.
Hi, Doug. Thanks for having me. Excited.
Thank you for coming along, and thank you for reading Native Son by Richard Wright to talk to me about it. Again, we're going to be talking about Richard Wright's Native Son. It was originally published in 1940, which I guess is a kind of, I think is an interesting moment in American history, and certainly in the history of cities like Chicago and in Chicago in particular, because this is post-Depression, just on the edge of the Second World War, as far as America is concerned. And it's also kind of smack in the middle of the Great Migration, which starts on the cusp of the First World War and lasts into the 1970 is usually when people make the cutoff. So there's this wave of African American immigration from the south of the country into northern cities in particular, where they start working in factories and populating urban centers like Chicago, Philadelphia, New York, Detroit, etc. And I guess on that note, where I thought we would start is turning right to the last pages of the novel. We'll get in later to what the novel's about and so on and so forth. But there's a moment in the trial of Bigger Thomas that happens to takes up a big chunk of the novel, in which Buckley, the man prosecuting him, says, "The more horrible the crime, the more stunned, shocked, and dismayed is the tranquil city in which it happens, the more helpless are the citizens before it." I have my margin of my copy. I've just drawn an exclamation point with tranquil city circled, because there's no small amount of irony in that statement, I suppose. The portrait of Chicago that we get in this novel is not necessarily one of a tranquil city, no. Or one that anyone can reasonably conclude is tranquil.
No, not at all. I think in some ways we are given a snapshot of a city from the very early pages that is bifurcated, that is segregated, that, you know, groups of people have two very different experiences in. You've got an ownership society, primarily white, and you have the black society existing on the margins, which is something that Bigger says a number of times, his mother says. It's an existence with limited opportunities and a system that is built to keep that status quo.
Yeah, I wonder if maybe thinking about the specifics of that system, as you've given us a really nice outline there. And it's interesting to think of that description as something that isn't tranquil. That's a portrait of an intranquil city, I guess, is the argument that I'm proposing.
Yeah, inherent tension, right?
And drilling into the specifics of that is interesting in this novel, because I think one of the real strengths of this novel, of which I think there are a million strengths, I really like this novel a lot, and we'll talk about some of the ins and outs of that later, but one of the interesting things is that Richard Wright has constructed a set of characters who embody that divide. So the guy, Mr. Dalton, who offers he's a rich white landowner, company owner,
owns a lot of land,
a lot of land and a company. Yeah, and he owns the slum in which Bigger lives, and he also is offering employment to Bigger as a means of demonstrating his altruism, and he donates ping pong tables to the rec center as a means of demonstrating his altruism. But in the meantime, he's profiting from their poverty and keeping them impoverished. And so he's a literal embodiment of that segregation. He's a literal embodiment of the division outside of the specific segregation of the economic division which intersects with the racial segregation. And he's there's a lot of imagery of blindness in this novel. And he's kind of morally, ethically blind to the problems that he's creating and perpetuating.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the fascinating things about it, and in a way, and you can tell me if this is a really unfair thing to say, I would say in a way he's also an embodiment of trickle-down economics. You know, he has all of these things. His gains come from a collective impoverishment, in a way. I hope that I'm using the word correctly in this sense, because he's not upgrading his buildings. He's not providing great places for people to live. He's only providing opportunities for what? Three or four people and ping pong tables. And, you know, so what gets down that he thinks will make some sort of difference is literally, you know, a drop in the bucket compared to the way that he is perpetuating this lack of good, sustainable, helpful housing and jobs.
Yeah. And it's one of the things that I guess is interesting is that he's not presented as a malevolent guy in the novel.
Not
at
all.
But his presence is a malevolent presence.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, if anything, he's as like a good-hearted person who's just trying to help others, but the problem is he has the means to help many, but he's only helping a few. And that's ultimately, I think, part of the larger problem.
And he doesn't understand. Because one of the things that I think is really interesting about this novel is it, somehow we've managed to go right to one of the minor characters, but is that it's a novel about people not understanding. It's also a novel about people who end up being representatives, whether they want to or not, of their race and their economic situation. And it's also about people who don't understand the implications of the position that they occupy with respect to their economics and race. So the argument I would make is that none of the characters understand that. Mary Dalton, who gets murdered by Bigger right near the beginning of the novel, to call that a spoiler would be to, I think it happens so early in the novel, you can't really call that a spoiler. It's the hinge, the inciting action of the novel.
Right? Yeah.
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 She doesn't understand her own position in relation to her privilege and race and poverty, even though she thinks she does and she's trying to. Bigger certainly doesn't understand it. He comes to understand it over the course of the novel to some degree. Mr. Dalton, Mrs. Dalton don't ever understand it, and so on and so forth. And those dynamics, the tragedy, one of the tragedies of the novel, I guess, is the lack of understanding and the dynamics of those lack of empathy that people have towards others, but also understanding that they have of themselves.
Well, that's a really great point, Doug. And I think it's especially important because the reason why people, or the characters in this case, lack this understanding is because they live apart from one another. They don't have these opportunities for human connection and to have a genuinely real sense of what it's like living in this particular area or neighborhood, what the difficulties are, what the interesting parts are. And I think Mary is, you know, is definitely a character who is interested in traversing that divide. She pays for it ultimately, mainly because of societal expectations, worries, fears. I mean, Bigger in particular thinks, well, you know, when he's caught in a bad situation, it doesn't matter now because I'm guilty. You know, society will view me as 100% guilty, so I need to do anything I can possibly do to try to get out of this situation. But I believe, I just looked for the quote very quickly, forgive me, I couldn't quite find it, but I'm absolutely certain that Bigger has this realization when he's spending time with Mary that she's treating him like a human being. And he actually finds that quite confusing because he's not been dealing with that before.
So there's an incredible, what I think is a really incredible long scene or set of scenes. Maybe we should set a bit of scene for people here. So Bigger, the novel opens with him chasing a rat around his tiny flat that he lives in with his brother and his mom. He's got this job opportunity where he's going to be a chauffeur for Mr. Dalton, who again is the guy who owns the slum in which Bigger is chasing rats around the kitchen/bedroom/living room.
Yeah.
And then on his... So he goes to this interview, which is awkward in and of itself, in this rich man's house in the white neighborhood. And then he gets hired as the driver. And basically the first thing he has to do is drive the daughter and her friend around town. And that becomes a series of scenes and moments that basically do a few different things. It's hard to talk about, I find, in this novel, talk about any one scene and say, oh, this scene does this, because almost every scene is doing a couple of multiple different things depending on, yeah, which perspective you want to look at it from. And so it serves to show his, you know, the alienation that these two characters have from one another. It shows his confusion over his place with respect to her, because she is this liberal-minded, rebellious, I guess, communist or communist sympathizing young woman who's trying to push boundaries and trying to, she's earnest, but stupid in a way about how she goes about dealing with
she doesn't realize how awful she makes Bigger feel. I think she's trying to make him feel included. She's trying to treat him like an equal, which he's really struggling with, because that's the thing. It's not just person to person here. He's in a professional capacity. He's trying to do a job. He feels that it's crossing boundaries in that way. It's obviously crossing racial boundaries, segregated boundaries in Chicago at that time to a degree, right? I mean, it wasn't segregated like the South was segregated, but it's fairly clear that as far as real estate is concerned, it was indeed very segregated. So yeah, that, I mean, all that's very difficult. The only thing that I would add, because I think you had a pretty great summary there, is that Bigger is torn between continuing a life of petty crime or taking this job, like actually taking the opportunity, potentially bettering himself. I mean, he's been running around with his gang a little bit. There's some really interesting snapshots, I think, into gang mentality and what it takes psychologically, you know, to pull jobs like that. I was pretty impressed with a few of the snapshots of that. But ultimately, yeah, I mean, he decides to take the better offer and ends up in just a series of pressurized events. It's like, I don't know how else to say it. Escalatingly pressurized events that really lead to Mary's death.
Let's circle back to the gang culture that he starts off in, because that's also, I mean, that's where some of your expertise as a writer and thinker comes in anyway. In a lot of discussions of this novel, a thing that's focused on a little bit less, because it seems almost like a prologue to the rest of the novel, right? We see him with his buddies doing things, and it serves as a way of characterizing him and his situation. And then, because he's once he murders her, he accidentally smothers Mary when she's drunk and he's trying to bring her home and do right by her.
And the mother's in the room and he's terrified of her finding out that he's there with her.
Yeah. And once he does that, he's out of all societies.
Yeah.
For various reasons, which we might get to. But I'm interested in hearing from you a bit more about what you thought about those early pages and the way that he operates on his own terms in that, in his milieu, with his gang of guys. They're going to go and boost a grocery store at the beginning, and the way he treats them and so on. Please say more.
Okay. Wow. Why, thank you. Well, it's definitely an escalation. So they're in the midst of planning an escalated armed robbery that they've never done before. And Bigger is driving this, even though he's terrified. You know, I have to admit, you know, there were so many moments when I was reading that and I just thought, wow, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. I mean, obviously, my expertise is like late 80s, early 90s gang members in Los Angeles. But I can honestly tell you there are few to no differences in the way that Wright is describing the psychology of escalating violence and being more and more okay with it. And you know, it starts with the rat. You know, killing the rat. He does it relatively easily. He feels no remorse. Everyone else in the apartment is freaking out. He's got no problem with it. And then we start learning more about why he might have no problem with it. It's because of some of the things he's been doing on the street with the guys. We also see his leadership mentality. So for me, it's page 28 in book one, Fear, where Bigger is talking to Jack and just letting him know, you know, what needs to be done in order to execute a job. To make him ready for a job, you have to make him scared two ways. You have to make him more scared of what'll happen to him if he don't do the job than of what'll happen to him if he pulls the job. So again, I mean, it's small and it's simple, but to be perfectly honest, this level of understanding that Wright shows is absolutely dead on, because this idea of being able to inspire fear and to make the fear of not doing something greater than doing something is ultimately the push point, you know, to create mm-hmm. greater violence. Obviously, that doesn't end up working out, but I think it's safe to say that because of this priming, so to speak, this operating outside of the normal world, which Bigger has already psychologically opted out of. I mean, it's not there for him. It's not built for him. It's there to exclude him, to put him down, and to throw him in jail. I mean, at one point, he even describes the part of Chicago he's living in as a jail. You know, they're over there.
Yeah.
We're over here. And I feel like, I think he says, like, I feel like I'm looking through a knothole in the fence. He feels completely excluded. And what's more, there's a large barrier that will keep him from going there. But of course, I think the beauty of the book and the conflict that will drive it forward is the author removes that obstacle and pushes him toward that world. And he has no choice but to interact with it, unfortunately, to quite a deadly event.
Well, and it also comes back, that the same idea comes back in a new way towards the end of the novel when the trial is happening, because his defense attorney, when he's pleading for him to not be executed, says, if you put this guy in prison, you're gonna give him a freedom he's never had before. Because he's gonna be, even though he'll be a number, he'll have an identity that is mm-hmm. just his, and he'll be treated as an equal by the other inmates in prison. And it goes on and on about it. And there's two ways of looking at that. One is like, it's some weird utopian view of what prison is like. And the other is that it's a really weird, it's like a really crazy dramatic irony, or not dramatic irony, a really crazy irony, and really quite cynical irony, that this guy who has started in a place that he considers a prison, in which he is not an individual, he's only on a certain level an individual, can only become, by being imprisoned, become some kind of autonomous being, or only by killing in the middle of the novel or beginning of the middle of the novel does he become autonomous in some way. And the end point of that is that to function societally or socially, prison offers him that identity or a confirmation of that identity. And it's not meant to be like, the lawyer isn't saying this is great for him, but he's pointing out, you know, he's pointing out the ironies of what's happening. And so the metaphorical prison at the beginning becomes the idea of real prison at the end.
Yeah, I found that moment that you've pointed out so beautifully really, really challenging as a reader. Mm-hmm. You know, I guess I'm lucky enough to have done years of research on prisons in America, and it's not good. So, you know, what you mentioned initially was exactly my reaction of like, what the H are you talking about, man? Yeah. No, but the beauty of the book, and especially that moment, is that as true literature does, it challenged me and it made me think more about, well, wait a second, like, is this true? Like, what are the ways in which Bigger might actually be more free in a confined space? And I think if anything, the conclusion I came to, you know, rightly or wrongly, is that he would finally have the opportunity to learn self-awareness in such a space that he so clearly could not learn outside, mainly because of desperation, because of certain desires and driving forward towards other things. It's interesting as well, because then it finally circled back, you know, with my own experience of definitely speaking with formerly incarcerated people and former gang members, of realizing that in almost every case, you know, the folks who when they get out are managed to turn their lives around and really have that second shot, it almost always comes back to reading. Like the ones who genuinely read and educate themselves and actually have the space to do so and really engage and really think about something because they want to is really affirmative and life-changing, which is, look, Bigger would be getting life without, essentially. Life without possibility of parole, if indeed, you know, they decide not to execute him. But it was so, it was just great. I mean, I felt challenged in the best possible way of, wait, because you know, initially, wait, that's not true. What? You know, you don't know what you're talking about. And then kind of working my way through it and being like,
shut
wow,
up,
okay.
Richard Wright.
Yeah. Speaking to me so beautifully from 1940s America, like, yeah, man, like, yeah. What I need to do is listen and read with a broader mind and try to reach a conclusion that feels like it fits.
Yeah, it's a super interesting pair. It's 404 in my edition, by the way. I think our pages line up. They did at least on page 28. They might have gone out of whack by now, but it's an interesting paragraph because it step by step walks you through its own logic, which again I think is it's a truthful and quite cynical irony, but it has a certain it asks you to look in the mirror or look at the situation in a particular way, and it holds your head in place while it's asking you to look, so you can't look away.
Yeah.
And the last sentence of that paragraph is, steel bars between him and the society he offended would provide a refuge from hate and fear. I want to come back to hate and fear in a minute. But then he goes on and he says two really interesting things. You cannot kill this man, Your Honor, for we have made it plain we do not recognize that he lives. So this is a white defense attorney recognizing this. Again, it's like this is bigger as inseparable from his race in people's eyes. It's one piece of that segregation puzzle that we started out talking about a little bit. And he's saying we're not even looking at him and calling him a human being. So we can't kill him because we're not killing him. We're just killing this thing that we fear.
Yeah.
And Bigger contemplates that earlier in the novel. So I say give him life. This will not solve the problem which his crime exemplifies. That remains perhaps for the future. But if we say we must kill him, then let us have the courage and honesty to say, let us kill them all. They are not human. There's no room for them. Then let us do it. One thing that's interesting, I mean, that's a caustic statement.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's interesting, I think, in this novel is when people, how people use pronouns. There's an earlier scene, the scene we were talking about, where Mary and her friend Jan have Bigger drive them into, they want to slum it in a chicken joint in the south of Chicago. And so he has to take them to the restaurant where he goes with his friends, and his girlfriend comes over and makes fun of him because he's sitting there with these white people and so on and so forth. And she, in Bigger's presence, starts talking about them and those people. And the them and those people, he's one of them sitting in the same car as her, and she's not understanding that. Earlier in the scene, she does talk to him and tries to take him seriously as an individual, but then she extrapolates it and forgets that he's even really there as she talks about those people and what they do and what they're like and so on and so forth. And here is a different side of that same thing. So instead of saying you, it's pushed into them. And here this is like the logical endpoint of that the lawyer is spreading out here. You're basically not recognizing these people as human the moment you say we have to kill him. As an example or whatever.
You mentioned previously that the defense attorney is white. I would just add that he's also Jewish. I mean, and I believe he's a communist sympathizer as well. And that's why he's being, why he's part of this. And I was really blown away by that line about let us kill them all, especially, you know, and then I looked at once again, when this book was published, you know, given the background of the defense attorney, I was like, wow, man, wow. It's almost as if he foresaw, you know, what a more honest, if far more horrible society would do. You know, they would take it to a natural, quote unquote, honest solution, courage and honesty. You know, you're right. Our page numbers do match up. And I'm really happy to hear that, because I went back to the first paragraph on 404 that you were quoting from.
Yeah.
My note in the margin to the left of that paragraph is, this is a very imperfect understanding of prison. So that was when I was first having that issue of, wait, what?
Yeah.
Like, what are you talking about? Obviously, you know, thankfully I was able to work through that. But, you know.
It's one of those. So I'm going to take a little detour again here, because it's one of the things, one of the, I guess, criticisms leveled at this novel often is that, I was going to say by them, the one of the things that they say, I'm doing the
pronouns,
is that it, you know, it's kind of clunky. It just the end of it becomes these speeches, and it's just kind of almost like Wright is propagandizing on behalf of his political beliefs and so on and so forth, because he's a communist at this time and everything. And
oh, okay, interesting.
And I remember, so I've read this novel a few times, and I've taught it a few times, and I remember the first time I read it being quite anxious about, because I'd read other Richard Wright and really liked it, and I remember being quite anxious about getting to the point where I was going to be like, oh, this novel isn't style, you know, it's kind of a mess, and it's just this didactic thing. And I see that criticism. I think there's something to it. But I also never really got that bothered by it, even when it gets kind of long-winded and repetitive at times. Because I think the construct of the... It's a court drama. It becomes a courtroom drama. And, like, we watch these things on TV and films all the time. And partly what a courtroom drama allows you to do is create a dramatic situation in which people can give speeches like this, because that's what courtrooms are partly for, right? Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. So like the Chicago 7 film, the Aaron Sorkin one that came out a few years ago, is like all these speeches. And like, I mean, people can't see this on a podcast, but I can on my screen. You just made a face at me, but I really liked that movie.
I made a face,
you know?
I admit it.
And it's mostly culled from, like, you know, it's reworkings of transcripts of the Chicago 7 trial and stuff in it, you know, but I feel like it works here partly because it is, I can imagine a lawyer going in grandstanding like this. Because it's creating public record and whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I've never, although I see the point of that criticism, and I think it's one worth thinking about, I always get a little bit miffed when people kind of dismiss Native Son, or dismiss that part of Native Son, and it's like, oh, it's this great thriller that turns into a bunch of speeches. And I just don't think that's right. I think that's to misunderstand a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, it's
what's
arguably
going on, or
the most important part of the book, because we're finally connecting why these crimes and events happen to a broader sociological construct and law enforcement system and justice system. So, look, you know, it was interesting because I hadn't read this book in 20 years. I think when you asked me to read it, I had a very different experience this time than I did last time. I think the first time I read it, it was very similar to what you're describing. Like, oh, I was so gripped. I was so anxious, nervous. It's so well written line by line in terms of how it's taking us through Bigger's journey. Will he be caught? It's so well written that it absolutely makes the second half feel slow, dull, plodding, because you've been so amped, and then you hit the midpoint and you have to go down a pretty slow descent depending on how quickly you read it. And I tend to read, you know, those portions not incredibly quickly because I'm trying to take it on board.
They're hard to read quickly as well.
Yeah. No, it is, because
a lot of them are long speeches, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, it was, however, reading it now, you know, as a novelist in my 40s, I think one of the things that stood out is it felt like our version of Crime and Punishment, which was, and as a result, I think you have to have the punishment. It can't be all about the crime. It really has to be an indictment of the system in order for this to make sense more broadly. Is it the easiest and best reading experience? Not necessarily. I mean, it depends on what you're after. Yeah. If you think it's going to be a thriller all the way through, you're going to be freaking disappointed. But guess what? It's a great work of literature. And great works of literature challenge you. They push you to think more deeply about how this world works.
Yeah. What you said there is really interesting to me, because one of the questions I always ask myself about novels in particular that I'm reading that aren't doing what I expected or what I thought they might, or I start not liking them, is like I start asking myself, well, like, how much of that is my problem? And
most
a lot of the time, a lot of
that
is my problem. So my not liking this thing stylistically, whatever, that's my problem. And now I have to get over it and see and think, start thinking about what this novel is trying to do. And I don't have to get to the end of the novel and like it, but I have to get to the end of the novel and understand it, right? Which is a different thing. And here,
well, it has to be a worthwhile experience. That doesn't mean it needs to be fun.
Yeah. Exactly. And here, I think I just think it's really, I just think it's so interesting what he does. And the fact that he decides to do this long, drawn out courtroom drama where everyone's talking about Bigger, and Bigger is sitting there, sometimes reacting to it, sometimes not reacting to it. You know, with his fate is just sitting there being decided by all the, everyone but himself. And it, I just think it works really well for me. And it, you know, I'm not sure people would write a novel this way now. You know, 1940 is kind of a long time ago. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I don't really care about that either. I think as a, as an artistic achievement, it's a really interesting one. One of the reasons I've already touched on this briefly was like, I was talking about the pronouns and using them, and you're saying, you know, he's saying, you are saying they are not human if you do this. And then I hear the echo of Mary Dalton saying, oh, they're so, she's saying in that passage, I might try and find it while I'm jibber jabbering about it, but she's basically saying, I see them as so human. They are so much realer.
Yeah, but
and
the language
so
is already
so
distancing.
That. Yeah, exactly. And you, and so then you hear this kind of hammer at the end when he's saying, you know, when you other, this is what othering really ultimately means.
It's the natural
endpoint.
Yeah,
exactly. In fact, my marginal note says logical endpoint.
What?
So you,
do
your
I win the
has
bingo?
Echoed my marginalia. Yeah, you definitely win. You win novel romantics bingo.
Yay!
But then the other words are at the end of that paragraph, the sentence I read out, a refuge from hate and fear.
Yeah.
And hate and fear drive this novel in so many ways. Fear, I in a seminar discussion some years ago with one of my final year seminar groups where we talked about this novel, we came to the conclusion that fear isn't just like an emotion in this novel, and it's not just a theme in this novel, it's a force that drives the novel, drives almost everything in the novel. And you can, especially Bigger, he's afraid of everything from the beginning. How you talked about this in his explanation of how you get someone to commit the crime. It's partly about driving fear in them. He's afraid when he shows up at the Dalton's house. He's afraid when he's driving them to the restaurant. He's afraid when he's in the car and they're getting drunk in his presence. He's afraid when he kills her. He's afraid when he's on the run. And he stops being afraid at some point. When he, you know, towards the end, he's sort of letting go of that. He's learning to let go of that fear. And it's too late.
Hmm. Well, there are moments even after Mary's death where he makes some really interesting psychological leaps and finds an element of freedom, an element of escape. I believe escape is also one of the terms that Wright uses, because it's an opportunity to be, you know, he has been, as far as he's concerned, outside of society. But now to have committed such a heinous crime, he really is outside of society. And when, you know, society catches up with him, they'll cast him out immediately. I think he's quite aware of that. But, you know, I wanted to actually point out something very quickly. It's a small digression, and I hope you're going to allow it.
I will allow it in this instance, yes. I love a small digression,
you.
Ryan.
Thank you for weighing in.
As long as you give me a page number.
Yes, page 106. We're in book two, Flight. So obviously fear has brought us here. Book one, fear, kind of catapulting us to flight post-killing. But I, you know, I think maybe it's just because of where I'm at in my life, and I'm doing a ridiculous amount of research on serial killers right now. Don't ask why. It's a long story. But there were some moments here, and I'm doing, unfortunately, a lot of kind of the hardcore psychological research and reading, you know, FBI profiling reports and things of that nature. So it's, I was stunned at how well Wright characterizes the psychology in 1940, because so many of these terms, like, so he imagined it so clearly that it actually fits with some of this new understanding. We have, of course, on 106 that, you know, Bigger had killed many times before. His crime seemed natural. He felt that all of his life had been leading to something like this. There was in him a kind of terrified pride. Look, even the pride is fearful and full of terror. And feeling and thinking that someday he would be able to say publicly that he had done it. But I think what really hit me was this moment of, now that the ice was broken, could he not do other things? What was there to stop him? That is almost identical to the kind of breaking point moment that you'll see in with multiple murderers. Mm-hmm. And it's described that way in the psychological literature. So when I got to that point, I just went, oh my gosh, I had to put the book down. I'm like, wow, that's dead on. And it was dead on in a kind of elemental human understanding way that it was years before mm-hmm. this research was able to put terms and understanding to it.
There's two interesting things, or, well, there's more than two, but there's two that I want to talk about on that. One of them is, so it's a rhetorical question, right? Now that the ice was broken, could he not do other things?
What was there to stop him? Yeah.
Just in terms of the novel, just in terms of this novel and this, the plot of this novel and the events of this novel, there's something interesting here because, first of all, he killed Mary by accident, which is what this this page that is about, really. It's him saying, although it was an accident, he's taking ownership over his action, despite the fact that he didn't mean it. So from one point of view, what he's really done is manslaughter, or I don't know. I wouldn't want to get – I'm not a lawyer. But he's killed her accidentally.
Yeah, I don't
– like he. Anyway, it depends, I don't want to get into
it
that
depends
argument.
On how the DA charges it, man. I don't know that manslaughter would be on the books.
But he's killed her accidentally. He didn't go out that day intending to kill her. The circumstances, he's accidentally killed her. But the answer to that rhetorical question is yes or no, because there's nothing to stop him. And he does deliberately murder his own girlfriend later in the novel. And so one of the things that's interesting, again, it's all these complicated things about whose lives matter and who are them and who is the individual Mary Dalton. She's killed. It is claimed that he raped her and murdered her. He didn't rape her.
Yes, but it was non-provable because he successfully burned the body.
Right, because he burned the body. But he murdered her. But then he goes out and deliberately murders his girlfriend while covering his tracks, Bessie. Mm. And that crime, no one in the Tranquil City cares about that crime.
No. I mean, they care about charging him for it and finding a way to show culpability in the previous crime in Mary's death. I mean, that's definitely something that
it's
DA
about making him
really
a bigger
hard.
Monster, right?
Yes. Yes, exactly.
It's not about the poor victim, because she gets othered or themed as well.
You know, it's interesting, and I'm so glad you jumped back to the pronoun, because I just recognized something about page 106 that I had not recognized before we had this conversation, especially in regard to pronouns. And the thing that really jumped out to me, and I put a star next to, was the line, "The thing to do was to act just like others acted, live like they lived. And while they were not looking..." Mm. "Do what you wanted." And again, this was kind of the stone cold shiver moment for me of, you know, the hiding in plain sight kind of serial killer narrative, you know, the whole deal that you hear again and again and again, which is, you know, neighbors being interviewed on the street. "Oh, he seemed like a quiet guy. Like, I don't know where this is coming from." Well, because he was acting just like you acted.
Like you acted.
And then when you weren't looking, he was doing what he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So it's another clever twist on pronouns, basically making broader society they. You know, there were those who do not kill, and then there was him who did kill. He was able to triumph over it, a triumph of will, so to speak. That, of course, once he's done it, he's able to do it again. And it's not as... I mean, it's, for me, that was probably the hardest part of the book to read is when he... kills Bessie. I mean, that was really brutal.
Oh, yeah. It's really brutal. It's a really brutal, brutal moment. And so much... Maybe this is true. In thinking about just that, like, thriller aspect of the novel that we talked about a while ago, that's to some degree the climax of that. Is that second murder, and it's the most brutal moment, far and away the most brutal moment of the novel,
and it seals his fate as well.
Yeah, and it's happening in this maelstrom of all kinds of things. That there's a massive police manhunt going on. They're going door to door through the black neighborhoods. There's the media in this the media presence in this novel is interesting, and also one of those things that I think holds up as a parallel to today, and the way it's all through newspapers, of course, in this, that there's this like media hysteria where special editions of the paper are coming out with these big headlines that get more and more outrageous about bigger and more dehumanizing of him and of the community, the African American community here as a whole in the tranquil city.
Mm-hmm.
And that murder of Bessie happens in the height of all of that, when he's really trapped by everything. In the other thing that is interesting in that passage on page 106, Ryan, is where he says, "It was as though he had an obscure but deep debt to fulfill to himself in accepting the deed."
Hmm.
And that's a really ambiguous sentence.
Yeah.
I always get a bit angry when writers tell me, like, the cliche way to put this would be, there was something deep inside that, and you're like, what if there's something there? Tell me what something is. But and Wright is a better writer than that. And so he says there's an obscure but deep debt to fulfill to himself in accepting the deed. And this is one of the central things about what happens to him, about these ideas of fear and hate as well, that the part of the obscure debt is that this is a step for him to not feel afraid anymore.
Hmm.
Now, we can agree, we can argue about the ethics of that. And like, you shouldn't have to be driven to kill someone to feel free.
I mean,
and that's part of the point that Wright is trying to
make. No,
that's part of the point that Wright is trying to make, right? Is that he's not holding up Bigger Thomas as like a paragon of virtue at any point in this novel.
Mm-hmm.
And partly what he's saying is, this is, to what degree is this? How is he, I'm trying to think of the right way to put this, how is this guy supposed to understand himself in a society that never gives him the opportunity to understand himself, whether he wants to or not is another thing. And Wright isn't saying feel sorry for Bigger Thomas at any point in this novel.
No,
but he is saying take Bigger Thomas seriously.
Yeah,
take his humanity seriously. And that's a different thing. It's a more troubling thing. It's a more difficult thing.
I think it's also saying, to a degree, understand how some of these crimes can occur because of societal positions, obstacles, difficulties. And I think in a way it was an incredibly bold, courageous decision to take a character who is not the hero, right? This is not a hero story. This is a story about how we treat the violent, the least educated, the most deprived and pushed to the side, and yet and you know, clutch pearls when, you know, folks decide to do things that are outside the boundaries, that the incredibly restrictive boundaries that have been set. And it's also, especially the second portion of the book that you were talking about earlier, it's also about, well, what kind of society do we want to be? What kind of society can we even hope to be if we don't find ways to acknowledge humanity on a broader level? And ideally, I mean, find a way to discourage, prevent, and make it so that these crimes don't happen. But guess what, man? I mean, it's 2022. These types of crimes are happening all over the world all the time. Yeah. I mean, if anything, it's just an insight into how things were happening in South Side of Chicago in 1940, but it's still so deeply human and so emblematic of so many broader issues that we all struggle with, regardless of country or city.
Yeah, another one of those things. I hope I'm not shoehorning this too much, but it's been kicking around in my mind while we've been talking that Bigger's introduction to Mary Dalton is an interesting moment that I think reflects some of these things as well, or shows one of those barriers that when he first sees her, it's in the cinema. He's in the movie theater with his friends to go see a movie, and there's a newsreel. Yeah. And she's in the newsreel because she's down in Florida or something with her, like, mm-hmm. it's like a feature on the Children of the Jet Set kind of thing. And she's down frolicking and it's in the newsreel and he's looking at her and kind of ogling her on the screen. And so
it's
unreal as bigger Tom. Yeah. Well, yeah. Bigger is unreal as bigger Thomas's life is to the Daltons or whoever. Mm-hmm. She's mediated as soon as she comes into his life, and there's the life that he sees of white people, what he understands of white people is just as other. It's not as dangerous to them until he murders her, I suppose. But it's not oppressive to them in the way that his life is being oppressed by these structures that we talked about at the beginning of the hour. But their lives are only come into contact in mediated ways until he gets hired, and then it's got this other dynamic involved. And it's
sure.
I don't know, this I just think that his attunement to media and mediation is interesting and quite easy to map into 2022 if you want to, I'm not asking you to do this, but as like a kind of way of thinking about how this novel is relevant in, you know, 80 years later. One of them is thinking about that media angle.
Well, you're absolutely right in terms of how he first comes into contact with her by way of the celluloid wall, which I think it's probably worth saying that, you know, the way we've been told Bigger views life through the knothole in the fence. I mean, how big is a camera lens? I mean, that's basically the same thing that you're being given there. It also casts Jan as a villain to an extent, as far as I understand, which helps Bigger later in the plot concoct a way to push the police towards him as opposed to toward himself. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I don't necessarily want to go this path, but I would suggest to listeners, if they're at all interested, there is a modern adaptation of this. I believe HBO Films did it maybe a year ago or 2 years ago. And it does play with the ideas you're speaking about to a degree. And I think it's not the adaptation that I expected, but that doesn't mean it's not worthy as a result.
Yeah. One of my students, a number of years ago in the seminar that I was teaching on this, he gave a presentation in which he talked about Bigger Thomas as the people's champ, which I thought was an interesting idea. You just made a kind of slightly confused face, which is I think what I made when he started.
Yeah.
Which is what I did when he started. And then he convinced me by the end of his presentation, because he was talking about what he meant was that Bigger is kind of thrown out of the herd, so to speak. He's just a regular guy to some degree. He's then put forward and has to be this emblem of things. And if he's going to fail, he's being made to fail. Whether he wants to or not is another question. But he's being made to fail, and whether it's right or not is another question. But he's being made to fail for everyone, not just for himself. And if he succeeds, then he's succeeding for everyone and not just himself. But at the same time, all he wants to be is himself. He doesn't want to be the champion of the people. He doesn't want to be the demon of the people. He doesn't want to stand for anyone other than himself. And I've always thought since then I've thought that's an interesting idea and a useful way of thinking about Bigger is trapped. Again, this is social society constructs. Bigger's trapped by being a black man on the south side of Chicago in the late 30s, early 40s, and everything he does, he's made to be a representative of a people, whether he wants to be or not, for good or for ill. You know, it's like you go and work for Mr. Dalton and you're the upstanding young black man coming good out of the ghetto and blah, 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 blah. And you murder Mr. Dalton's daughter and you're the awful, degenerate kid from the ghetto who, you know, this is why they belong there and blah, 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 blah. And in the middle of the novel, this is in book two on page 241, Bigger says, "Why should not this cold white world rise up as a beautiful dream in which he could walk and be at home in which it would be easy to tell what to do and what not to do. If only someone had gone before and lived or suffered or died, made it so that it could be understood. It was too stark, not redeemed, not made real with the reality that was the warm blood of life. And this is bigger in this moment, almost becoming, I mean, the imagery is all, you know, Christ-like imagery. Imagery of the sacrifice of Christ, making Christ goes before, so, you know, to redeem your sins, so you don't have to. And this is him thinking, I would not have found myself in this terrible position if someone else had gone before and I'd learned a lesson. But of course, other people have gone before, but no one's learned the lesson out of it. And this is that kind of idea that the trial at the end is trying to make him into someone that can be freed so that the lessons can be learned. Whether it happens or not is a question for people to read the novel and decide about. But I think that's a kind of interesting idea about a way of trying to create a metaphor to understand this tension between being a person, an individual person, and being forced to stand in for all kinds of things that other people want you to stand in for.
Well, it comes down to an issue of narrative, doesn't it? I think to a degree, even your student had the People's Champ narrative that he then sought to prove through the course of the presentation.
He was a boxer, so that's why he...
then it fit.
Yeah.
I think one of the prevailing narratives through the book, and you've already mentioned it ably, is the media, especially the way the media characterizes the nature of the crimes, the manhunt, and the trial. So there are those three phases. But of course, we're primed for it, you know, previously with newsreels and other bits of newspaper information. There's also the narrative, I suppose, of how Bigger is looked at by the Daltons, how he looks at himself, how his family looks at him, which those are two very different things as well. We haven't really touched on it, but they're pretty fascinating. I mean, as a function of plot, I mean, Bigger really is set up to fail to a degree because this novel needs to say something and make a point.
Mm-hmm.
I think all great novels do, or at least set out to. I don't know, though. I mean, it's... I know I mentioned this earlier, but it's such a bold thing to pick as ostensibly the protagonist of your novel, as someone who does horrible things, because you're going to lose readers along the way. You're going to lose folks who will be turned off and perhaps won't be open to asking the difficult questions. That's certainly something I've had to deal with in my own work. I frequently write about characters who are not likable, don't necessarily get chances or opportunities, and sometimes make really dangerous decisions and have to live with the consequences of that. And I think ultimately, perhaps what makes this book so strong and perhaps absolutely justifies how it ends is that it's an exploration of consequences. And I can't say that things have changed enormously much, you know, in the intervening, 82, 83 years since the book has been published.
Yeah. And one of the other parts of that tragedy for this novel is that Bigger doesn't have the equipment to articulate to himself the experience that he's going through. And it both contributes to the problems, but also makes the problems difficult to redeem.
Sure. And it drives the decision-making process, which in some cases is really broken and just leads him to you know, worse and worse mistakes. And he doesn't realize that until the end, when he actually has to spend time in a room by himself.
Yeah. And then they decide to kill him. And it's bleak.
Yeah, but I think it's bleak if you don't have a sense of how the justice system works in the United States, even to this day. I mean, what, death penalty is still up in 28 states? Please don't quote me on that. I've not checked lately, but this is still an American way of dealing with crime. It's still an American way of law and order, so to speak. Is it the right way? I know it's not the best answer, but I think it depends. In Bigger's case, you know, having been able to read a book, I don't think it makes the most sense. However, you know, in some cases, I think it's up to the judge and the jury. But I think the beauty of it being literature is it really is up to the reader.
Yeah, and it's a book that really challenges the reader to make decisions about not just the events that are taking place, but the variety of opinion and perspective that then gets mapped onto the events that take place. You don't just see Bigger doing his things, you see everyone else involved responding in kind, and where you sit amongst those responses is a very difficult path to navigate in this novel. It's really the tremendous achievement of this novel, I would say. We've only really scratched the surface of it in the hour or so that we've been talking. I hope that listeners who have not yet read the novel will be inspired to do so. Ryan Gaddis, I want to thank you so much for coming onto the Novel Romantics Literature of Chicago podcast, brought to you by the Amerikazentrum Hamburg. I really appreciate you coming on and spending so much time talking to me so eloquently about it. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Doug.
Just so you know, once again, the views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the guests or the host, not the Amerikazentrum, which does not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Thanks again for listening.